helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel. A recent question posed on the website asked about the Constitution of the Confederate States of America. Now, this was a rather lengthy but well-asked question, so I wanted to take proper time to answer it here on the radio. Well, then I also noticed that Congress is taking up a resolution for an Article 5 convention. Now, between the convention and the controversies around it, I thought that would be an interesting dovetail to talking about the question about the Confederate States of America. And with whatever time I have left, I want to look at some recent news articles, well, in the light of these two major questions. Well, hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. And this is an excellent opportunity, the chance to dive into a detailed and well-asked question and then kind of expand that into other things going on in current events. Now, if you want to ask a question, and especially if you'd like it answered on the radio, just go to constitutionstudy.com/questions or click the Ask a Question button in the menu bar, and you can ask a question. If you want me to answer on the radio, click the checkbox, which is exactly what this person did. His name is Peter. I'm not going to use his full name because I don't have permission, and I want to respect his desire to possibly remain anonymous, but Peter's a fairly common name. And he asked a question, and I want you to note not simply the question, but the way he went about it. He started with, "I'd like to pose a question that requires a framework of remarks." And he asked me to refute or correct these remarks at my discretion, which perfectly fine, right? He's setting the stage. And too often we forget that we always approach a question from our own point of view, our own worldview. So the opportunity to understand where he's coming from actually helps me answer his question. So I want to look at the framework. There are three remarks that he bases as the framework for his question. And I want to take each of them individually because I think they are interesting. So number one. The Confederate States of America seceded from the Union and adopted their own constitution in compliance with the Constitution of the United States of America. Okay, let's start right there because that to me is the crux of the question at hand. When the states seceded from the Union, was it in compliance with the Constitution of the United States? And the answer is no. There is no language in the Constitution about exiting the Union, about seceding from the Union. Now, I've done a little research on this. I actually went and researched the debates in the Continental Congress about the question of secession, and none of the Founding Fathers I could find, or at least I could think of, actually thought secession would be a good idea. They actually said it would be a bad idea. Basically, the idea is states could use this as a political weapon. You know, if a state doesn't get what it wants, it simply threatens to secede, and by doing so, disrupting the entire Union, which, by the way, is exactly what the Confederate States of America did. Now, I'm not a Civil War historian, but what I've researched so far, what I understand, my understanding is, as the Republican Party was gaining strength, as they were pushing this more anti-slavery agenda, the Confederate states were concerned that slavery would be outlawed. These states, these southern states that even though they had decades to prepare for the eventuality of slavery being removed, and back to the Constitution, Congress was not allowed to pass a law stopping the slave trade until 1808. As a compromise, they wanted to give the states 20 years to kind of figure out how to survive if they got rid of the slave trade. Now, again, politics got involved and the slave trade was not gotten rid of, although there's lots of legislation. We end up in the 1860s and the slavery still exists. It's still legal in many states, but there is now a national move to get rid of it. And the states in the Congress, the representatives in Congress, even the senators, were pushing back against this. And when it became obvious with the election of Abraham Lincoln that they weren't gonna win this day, well, they simply took their ball and went home. They seceded from the Union. Now again, there's no language, there is no mechanism for a state to leave the Union in the Constitution. There are mechanisms for them to join, but not to leave. So the only way for a state to... Now, let me get back to another point. I hear several people say, quote, the 10th Amendment, that claiming that the power to secede is one of those powers not delegated to the United States. Therefore, it remains with the states. That, to me, is a pretty weak argument. Is the right to secede is the right to break your word a right that a state could retain? So what these states did is they left Congress. All the representatives left Congress, and they claimed they were no longer part of the Union. They declared themselves independent, and they wrote their own constitution. Now, to be fair, this is not that different from what the colonies did in 1776. They said the government was corrupt, it was evil, we can't abide by it anymore. We secede from the British Empire and we set up our own constitution. Well, we set up the Articles of Confederation first, but each state has its own constitution. Each of the new states created a constitution, created their own government. They joined together under the Articles, which didn't work very well, so they end up going to the Confederation. So the very first point that is trying to be made here is that when the Confederate states left the Union, when they seceded for the Union, it was in compliance with the Constitution of the United States. That is not true. In fact, every elected official in one of those states, whether they served in the federal legislature or in a state office, violated their oath of office when they complied with the secession. See, Article 6, Clause 3 says, the senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. So when they seceded, they violated their oath or affirmation. They had given their word that they would support that Constitution, and they did not. So there's issue number one, is that when the states seceded, they were not in compliance with the Constitution. They were breaking the Constitution. They were violating the Constitution. They were going back on their oath or affirmation. Now, remark number two, the CSA was invaded and forced back into the Union, i.e. the war between the states, which is essentially a form of forced compliance. Okay, let's go back and look a little bit of the history. So during his inauguration on March 4th, 1861, Abraham Lincoln stated that the Constitution was a binding contract and that the state secession had no legal basis. This is mostly, I would say mostly true, right? There's no... The Constitution's a compact between the states. It is legally binding. These states were breaking that compact. And so that's what I'm saying. The no legal basis, well, by that standpoint, the Revolution had no legal basis either. So I'm not sure about the legal basis. But he went on to say that at that time, he did not plan to do anything that would force the Southern states into armed rebellion. He thought, at least according to the research I've found, that this could be negotiated out. So it was not the North that initiated, it wasn't the North that initiated armed conflict. It actually was the South. You see, while Lincoln said that he would not use force to give the South justification for rebellion, he did say he would protect federal installations. This is land owned by the United States. Fort Pickens in Pensacola and Fort Sumter in Charleston, South Carolina. You had Fort Jefferson in the Dry Tortugas and Fort Zachary Taylor in Key West, Florida. This is federal land owned by the United States that resided in these southern states, meaning the states didn't have a legal claim to this land. Now, as I understand it, I believe it was March 1861, Fort Sumter was low on provisions. Lincoln informed President Davis of the Confederate States that he was going to resupply the fort, but he promised that there would be no additional men or munitions sent, that he intended this to be a simple reprovision, but if his relief expedition was attacked, well, he would then reinforce a garrison and he would defend federal land. A general P.G.T. Beauregard was given the command to siege and ask for the surrender of Fort Sumter. The fort refused because, well, they were responsible to the present United States, not to the Confederate States. Then I believe it was the morning of April 12th, the Confederates opened fire on Fort Sumter. They attacked United States property, United States land. That was the beginning of the armed conflict. That's what took this from a dispute that could possibly be resolved into a fighting war. Now, as with any other fighting war, when someone loses that war, they surrender. So when he says that the Confederates were a form of forced compliance when they were forced back into the Union, that was part of their conditions of surrender. When a combatant surrenders, they often have to give, here are the conditions under which you are required to surrender. Here's what we will give you. Here's what you have to give us. So simply referring it as forced compliance is a bit of a misnomer. The Confederate States lost the war, and part of the surrender conditions included rejoining the Union. And then point number three he makes, remark number three, is the CSA ratified their own constitution on March 29th, 1861, which again is in accordance with the U.S. Constitution. It is not within accordance of the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land, Article 6, Clause 2. It does not recognize individual states have their constitutions, but it doesn't recognize a compact between multiple states that must be ratified by Congress. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in time of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded or on such imminent danger as will not admit delay. So this compact was not done in compliance with the Constitution. It was done in violation of the Constitution. A compact between the Confederate States of America, not approved by Congress, is not compliant with the Constitution. So we have these three framework remarks that are going to set up the ultimate question. And I want to get to that real quickly before the break comes up. So his question goes, based on the above remarks, is the CSA Constitution still in effect per the U.S. Constitution? Another way of phrasing the question may be, are the CSA acting outside of the U.S. Constitution by identifying with the U.S. instead of recognizing the Constitution that was ratified, in accordance with the U.S. Constitution? Maybe another way of phrasing the question is, isn't the CSA Constitution endorsed by the U.S. Constitution? And if so, is the CSA Constitution still theoretically in effect? If not, what nullifies the CSA Constitution? Was it the fact that the CSA was forced to agree to nullify it? If so, does it actually mean that it was nullified? And again, his question is based on the assumption that the acts of the Confederate States were in compliance with the Constitution, which they were not. So the short answer to this question, by the way, he said he was sorry for the long-worded question. I actually appreciated it. I appreciate it very much because it gave me the framework to understand where his question was coming from to answer what was actually there. The CSA was never, I should say, the CSA was never it was never done in compliance with the Constitution. It was never recognized by the Constitution. And in fact, the only way it could have been recognized is if, as the original 13 colonies did, the Confederate states won the war. If they had won their war for independence, then the CSA Constitution would be recognized. Other than that, no, it was not recognized. It was never, in my understanding, legitimate. Therefore, it was never enforced. It didn't have to be nullified. They simply lost, and the Confederate States, that union, disbanded. So I want to thank Peter both for his well-worded and important question. It was a very good question. I really appreciated it. And I want to thank all of you for giving me the time to answer it here on this program. Being it was such a long and detailed answer, I wanted to give a detailed question a fair response. Now, hopefully this segment has not put you to sleep. I hope this is not a cure for insomnia. But if you have problems sleeping, I got something that might help. See, Healthy Cell has a product called their REM sleep supplement. It helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. I use it, especially when I travel. My wife loves this stuff because it supplements. It's designed to support all four stages of sleep. Now just go to HealthyCell.com, find the REM Sleep, try any of their products, and when you check out, use a code OUTLOUD, and HealthyCell will give you 20% off your first order. So again, go to HealthyCell.com, try any of their products, make sure you try the REM Sleep, use the code OUTLOUD at checkout to get 20% off your first order, and we'll talk about the Convention of States right after this break.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is the McCullough Report. Healthy Cell REM Sleep Supplement is a combination of calming herbs, amino acids, minerals, and sleep hormone support for the four stages of the human sleep cycle. Fall asleep, stay asleep, get a deep sleep, and achieve REM, or rapid eye movement sleep. This is very important. So there are combinations that address, in this single product, the ability to fall asleep easily. There are others that help the body lower the body temperature, which is normal during sleep, and still others that cause a deep and lasting sleep. That's what so many people are after. And finally, interestingly, combinations that help creativity boosting during REM sleep. I can tell you, I use this one personally. It's in a microgel formula. I had a patient this last week who has long COVID syndrome, and she has terrible GI side effects, and she has GI hypomotility, and said, listen, she's not even tolerating pills or these chalky, large vitamins. I said, go to Healthy Cell. Get the Healthy Cell line. We use it in post-COVID syndrome patients, and this product particularly will help sleep get on track. Now, I tell people, listen, take it every night and do so for months and months. The body likes regular administration of any exogenous substance. Don't take it on and off. It's not like a sleeping pill. This is something you would take every night to get high quality sleep back into your day. And you feel better during the day after having better quality sleep at night. So go to HealthyCell.com and in the promo code type in OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support, delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. If you joined the Constitution study, you know, in the first segment, we talked about the Constitution of the Confederate States of America. Now let's talk a bit about our own Constitution and this House concurrent resolution to call a convention of the states. Now, there are some who believe that a convention of states will be the salvation of the republic. Others think it'll be lead to its demise. But let's understand a little bit. Let's get a little bit of context here, and let's actually take a look at the resolution. So there are two methods of proposing amendments. There's only one method of ratification. I should say one entity allowed to ratify. So in the history of this country, we have only proposed amendments to the Constitution via the congressional order, or otherwise, I guess better said, the congressional method. So Article 5 of the Constitution, which describes how we amend the Constitution, says the Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution. That is the only method we have used so far to propose amendments. But there is another one. Article 5 goes on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states shall call a convention for proposing amendments. That's why it's called an Article 5 convention sometimes. The idea is, okay, Congress can propose amendments, the states can propose amendments. The way that is done is through a convention. But notice, these are just for proposing amendments. They don't become law until they're ratified by the states. Article 5 goes on, which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states or by conventions in three-fourths thereof as one or other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress. So here we go. We now are talking, the House now says, okay, we now have the requisite state requests to do this. Reading from the concurrent resolutions, it's concurrent resolution 101, reads, whereas Article 5 of the Constitution of the United States states that the Congress, on the application of the legislature of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments to the Constitution. Absolutely right, absolutely true, quoted pretty much word for word. Going on, whereas congressional and state records of purported plenary applications for amendments on any subject and application for single subject fiscal responsibility amendments compiled by the Article 5 Library list 42 total applications over time, 39 active applications in 1979, 40 active applications in 1983, and at least 34 active applications in many years thereafter. So this is where things get a little interesting, where a little bit of playing politics is muddying the waters. See, there are several states have said, listen, we want a convention of the states, period, end of story. However, several of those states called for a convention of the states specifically to deal with fiscal responsibility amendments, a single subject call. Now, problem I have number one, I don't know how many of these are which. In other words, there's nothing in the Constitution that says you can call a convention and only limit and only have certain purposes. So we've got two different types of calls. I don't think there's a constitutional difference between them. There are a lot of people saying, no, you cannot mix the plenary requests with the fiscal responsibility requests. They must be considered separately. It doesn't say that. All it says is that, hey, if the legislatures ask for a convention, Congress shall call a convention. So there's problem number one. Here's problem number two. See, many of the states have actually rescinded their call for conventions. You see, I don't have a definitive list. I don't have a referenceable list. But based on the data I've been able to collect, there's probably about 15 or 20 of these states that originally applied for a convention that subsequently the legislature rescinded that application. So when Congress says there are 42 applications, I don't think that's entirely true, because more than the 8 necessary have rescinded those applications. But that doesn't seem to have been discussed here. So I'm not sure that this concurrent resolution is actually legitimate, Congress must show, they must show that the states that have applied for a convention of states. Going back to the resolution, whereas Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 85 stated that the Congress shall call a convention, nothing in this particular is left to the discussion of that body. That part, again, is absolutely true. When 34 states have, or when two-thirds of the states have asked for, have applied for a convention, Congress has no choice. They must call a convention. Back to the resolution. Whereas, beginning in 1979, when Congress appeared to have failed in its constitutional duty to count applications and call a convention for proposing amendments, the nation's debt was increased to more than $30 trillion from $830 billion, while the value of the dollars declined over 70%. Okay, start with the beginning. There were not 34 states total that had active applications. This goes back to that question. When a state can, when a state legislature says, no, we've changed our mind, we are rescinding our call, it appears that Congress is just ignoring that and counting them anyway. So, and then the question of the debt, that I find interesting, only because some of the states that applied, whether they were rescinded or not, specifically wanted to deal with fiscal responsibility. That must be what they're talking about. I don't know why, since they've got both plenary and fiscal responsibility. To me, it's just, you know, throwing words out to make it sound important. Continuing on, whereas the Constitution was ratified by convention delegates chosen in each state by the people thereof, and the 21st Amendment repealing prohibition was ratified in 1933 by a vote of the people for yes, pledged delegates in 38 of 39 convention states, and I have no idea what this has to do with this thing. This has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with this call. Yes, the original Constitution was ratified by convention delegates in the original 13 states. That's true. But we're not talking about a ratification convention. We're talking about a convention for proposing amendments. And yes, the 21st Amendment was repealed. Again, not by a convention for proposing amendments, but for a convention to ratify an amendment. Because remember, Article 5 says Congress gets to decide whether it's three-fourths of the legislatures that have to ratify a proposed amendment or conventions in three-fourths of the states. So again, this is misleading. This, I believe, is intentionally misleading. They make it sound like, oh, this happens all the time, it's not a big deal. No, this would be the very first time in our nation's history that a convention was called to propose amendments to the Constitution. Reading on, and this one I love. Whereas the Supreme Court's unanimous opinion in Cefalo versus Washington stated, electors have no ground for reversing the vote of millions of citizens. That direction accords with the Constitution, as well as the trust of the nation that here we the people rule. Again, this has nothing to do with the convention. Cefalo versus Washington had a question with unfaithful electors in a presidential election. And they, by the way, the Supreme Court did so in direct violation of the Constitution of the United States. See, here's the problem. When we modified the method of choosing electors, when we made it a state-by-state vote to choose that state's electors, the Constitution merely says the people choose electors. The Constitution does not require those electors to vote the way the majority of the people in that state chose them, right? The whole idea of choosing electors based on who they're going to vote for is not in the Constitution of the United States. Now, it is in the laws of many of the states, and I believe Washington was one of them. I don't remember the details of this case too deeply, but the idea was the people had voted for electors that promised to vote for one candidate, and several electors wanted to vote for somebody else. Now, what's interesting is the Supreme Court said electors have no ground to reverse the vote of millions of citizens. They weren't reversing the vote of millions of citizens. Millions of citizens chose those people to represent them in electing a president of the United States. This is a tremendous misunderstanding in how we actually elect the president. This is the equivalent of saying, listen, if a majority of people voted for the Democratic candidate for a seat in the House, that candidate cannot vote for a Republican proposed legislation, because that would be reversing the vote of millions of citizens. This is a terrible misunderstanding. Maybe tell me, would you like me to go into that in more detail? I know it's not a presidential election cycle, but I did cover it before the radio program back in the 2020 elections. I probably will cover it in the 2024 elections, Lord willing, the crick don't rise. But if you'd like me to talk about Ford, let me know. Go to the website, constitutionstudy.com, ask a question, simply ask, and I'll do that. So based on these criteria, which is iffy at best, Congress says it's time to call a convention. Reading from the resolution. As provided in Article 5 of the Constitution of the United States, and except as provided in Paragraph 2, Congress hereby calls a convention for proposing amendments to the Constitution of the United States and sets the date and place for the convention to occur during the 180-day period, which begins at the date the Archivist of the United States notifies Congress under Section 106C of Title I, United States Code, that the Archivist has identified plenary or issue-specific applications from at least two-thirds of the states calling for such a convention. And here's one of the concerns I have about the process. Not so much the convention, but the process. See, all Congress has to do is call the convention. Here they've claimed they're going to set up a period for the convention. In other words, the convention has to be within a 180-day period from the time that the Archivist of the United States notifies Congress that they have the two-thirds states required calling for a convention. It's not a time limit, it's not set by the Constitution. That is not a power delegated to the Congress, much less the United States. So we start to see Congress starting to interfere with the convention. But what is this paragraph 2 they're talking about? Well, it's an exception clause. Exception. Paragraph 1 does not apply if, prior to the expiration of the 60-day period, which begins on the date of the adoption of this concurrent resolution, the Archivist of the United States submits to Congress a certification that the Archivist finds that, as of such date, there have never been plenary or amendment-specific non-rescinded applications from at least two-thirds of the states calling for a convention for proposing amendments to the Constitution. And the Archivist includes in the certification a detailed explanation of the Archivist's findings for each state. So, okay, once Congress passes this resolution, the Archivist has 60 days to determine, oh, guess what? We've never really had the requisite number, the two-thirds states applications, if we take into consideration what has not been rescinded. Right? So if you take the plenary or amendment-specific applications that have not been rescinded, if there has never been more than 34, then this whole thing stops. Right? Now, this all sits in the hands of the Archivist of the United States. Now, I would like to, the Archivist is required to provide this information, a certification and a detailed explanation. I'd like to see this before Congress makes up its mind, but maybe that's where the Senate would amend this to say, no, this counting of the amendment or the request must be done in public. But there's one other piece to this. Reading from the resolution. Any proposed amendment at the convention called under this section shall be ratified by a vote of we the people in three-quarters of the states via state convention delegates, who shall have no ground for reversing the vote of millions of their citizens, based on Schiavallo versus Washington. Again, this is Congress meddling in the process. Congress has a very simple question at this point. Is it going to be by the legislature or by convention? They have no right to say the states must have the people vote. So Section 1B, again, constitutionally invalid. All they can do is say, state, you're going to do it by convention. It is then up to the state to call the state convention however they please. Right? This, you know, when people ask, are concerned about the convention of the states, this is where I get animated. It is the process. It is the details. I've said all along, my opinion is the convention state is perfectly constitutional. The problem is, do you really expect Congress not to meddle in the process? And here we see Congress meddling in the process. And they're using a Supreme Court opinion about presidential electors as justification to do this. Details matter, ladies and gentlemen. And should there be a convention, and should that convention propose amendments, there's no state is required to have a popular vote to decide how to, whether or not to ratify it. They call delegates. They call a convention however they want. If they want that convention to be able for everyone to vote, they can do that. If they want the people to choose delegates to vote on these, they can do it. The actual process of the convention within the state for ratification is a function of the state. It is beyond the purview of Congress. It is beyond the purview of the United States. By the way, the actual operation of the convention of states is beyond the purview of Congress. It is beyond the purview of the United States. All they do is call it. It is then up to the states to send delegates, and it is up to the convention itself to determine how it's going to organize itself. That's what was established by not only by the Constitution, but by the history and tradition of this nation. When the Constitutional Convention was called, the states chose delegates, and the delegates organized themselves as to figuring out how they were going to go about the discussions and the debates and what they would require in order to propose a new constitution. Now, I want to talk a bit more about the convention of states, but I'm going to get to a break really quickly, and I don't want to interrupt that thought, so let me do this real quick. Before I head off to the break, though, do me a favor. I want you to head to America Out Loud every day to get news and happenings. There's a great source of information. I get articles from there every day, and I'm posting them on my social media. I'm sharing them with others because there's some really, really great information there. And not only should you do this yourself, you should encourage others, friends and family. If you find this information useful, then by all means, share it. Take the stories, the articles, the videos, the podcast, share them with others, because you're not simply sharing good news. You're not simply sharing information. You're helping to secure the blessings of liberty, not just for ourselves, not just for our posterity, but for everyone in this nation.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day. Yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
All right, you've all heard Malcolm and the great Dr. Peter McCullough talk about the povidone iodine-based nasal spray Cofix RX. They talk about it because it's a product that actually works in combating colds, flus, and coronaviruses. Cofix is made in the USA and recommended by thousands of doctors and pharmacists nationwide. It's simple. By attacking viruses where they incubate, you make it easier for your body to heal. Check out the Cofix RX banner ad on AmericaOutLoud.com and save 20%. By using promo code OUTLOUD.
As Americans, we seek to form a more perfect union. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And God willing, we shall not perish from the earth. AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study. I'm glad you have. You know, this has been an interesting program. We've had a couple of really big topics I spent whole segments on. The Constitution of the Confederate States of America, and the Convention of States resolution currently in Congress. And you may be wondering, what do these two really have in common? Well, it comes back to the question of, just because somebody says so, does it make it so? The question I dealt with in the first segment had to deal with Is the Confederate state, the Constitution of the Confederate States of America, valid? Is it still in force just because these states said so? Then the Convention of the States, is this process being followed? Is this convention being legitimately called just because Congress says so? Can Congress manipulate the process just because they say so? And the answer is no. Which brings me to a bit more detailed discussion I want to have about the Convention of the States. As I said, some people think it's the salvation of this country. Some people think it'll be the destruction of the country. So would a Convention of the States be the salvation of this country? No. For one very simple reason. The problem is not the language of the Constitution. The problem is the people we hire to fill those positions. As John Francis Mercer said, it is a great mistake to suppose that the paper we are to propose will govern the United States. It is the men whom it will bring into the government and interest in maintaining it that is to govern them. The paper will only mark out the mode and the form. Men are the substance and must do the business. The problems, the vast majority of the problems we have in Washington, D.C., in the federal government, do not come from the language of the Constitution, but from the men who are perverting it. So changing the language of the Constitution isn't going to fix the problem. How can it? If Congress, if the federal government, if our state governments are going to ignore the language of the Constitution, how does changing that language fix anything? It doesn't. Now, are there things I would like to see amended in the U.S. Constitution? Yes, there are. I'd like to see the 16th and 17th Amendments repealed. Get rid of the direct income tax from the federal government and get rid of the popular election of senators. Return the Senate to its proper role of representing the states. Let the state governments choose the members of the Senate. I'd also like to see, a lot of people call for a balanced budget amendment. I have a different view. I would like to see borrowing limitations. See, right now, Congress can borrow as much money as they want on the credit of the United States. I would like to see limitations put on the borrowing, not the budget. And there's a couple reasons for that, and I won't take the time to go into here there. If you want, I'll talk about potential amendments at another time. All you have to do is ask. But if the Constitution already prohibits Congress from collecting taxes for things other than the common defense and the general welfare of the Union, the United States, not the states, not the people, if the Constitution already forbids unreasonable searches and seizures, if the Constitution already prohibits the infringement on your right to keep and bear arms, how does changing the language make any real difference? Congress and the presidency and the courts will simply find other ways to get around that pesky little Constitution. Now, will a convention of states destroy the Republic? Only if we let it. See, a convention, one of the biggest problems, I believe it's the John Birch Society talks a lot about this. They're really worried that a convention of the states will propose an entirely new constitution, completely foreign to our existing constitution, which is absolutely possible. There's nothing in the Constitution that says a convention of the states could not simply vote to repeal the Second Amendment, repeal the Fourth Amendment, rewrite the, create an entirely new constitution. It does not take effect unless 3/4 of the states approve it, right? Just because a convention of the states proposes these ridiculous, stupid amendments, they have no legal power in the United States until they are ratified by 3/4 of the states. And since the House proposition here, the resolution says it will be done by a convention in each of those states, then they would need conventions in 38 of the 50 states to approve effectively rewriting the Constitution. Now, I'm actually a little more concerned that it's done by convention rather than by the legislature, because it would be easy for the states to insulate delegates from the will of the people. Right? That's the one concern I have. You can have a state that effectively chooses delegates strictly from the political parties, strictly based on political fidelity, and basically, you know, ignores the will of the people and turns us into a banana republic. That's why I said it's possible, but only if we the people let it. It's one of the reasons why I say it is so important that we focus not solely on what's going on in Washington, but what is going on in our own backyards, in our counties, in our cities, and in our states. So is there a concern? Could it happen? Possibly. I don't think it likely, because while there are several states where this might happen, you think of the coast, you think of the traditionally deep blue states, New York, California, New Jersey, Delaware, Oregon, Washington, would they vote to make such drastic changes? Yeah, probably. But that's not enough for them to make this amendment part of the Constitution. You'd have to get a lot of those middle states, the states that are more red, the Floridas, the or at least purple, right? You'd have to get Indiana and Ohio and Tennessee and Kentucky and West Virginia and Iowa and the Dakotas. You'd have to get a lot more. And I still have enough faith in the American people that they would not allow the blessings of liberty to be wiped out in this country simply because a bunch of bureaucrats want it to happen. I'm realistic to know there will be political shenanigans, but I'm hoping the American people can elect people to represent them that would hold them, you know, to accountable. We have elections coming up in a few months, that we would elect people that would hold their oath of office, that would follow the Constitution and would follow the will of the people to not approve such nonsense, to not pick delegates that would approve such nonsense. It would allow the delegates to be chosen either directly by the people or would be chosen in such a way as to represent the actual demographics, the actual people in those states. So you may ask, why have I spent so much time on these subjects? And the answer is, it is our ignorance of the Constitution that leads many people to follow completely irrational, unconstitutional, illegal ideas. For example, I saw this article. There's a CNN correspondent, Bill Weir, who suggested that the Biden administration ought to mobilize the military to produce electric vehicles, claiming that if he doesn't, life on Earth is at stake. Now listen, this correspondent is completely allowed to have his own opinion. Personally, I think it's insane. I think it's nuts. I think it's completely divorced from reality, but he's allowed to have it. We live in a free country. I want to protect his liberty to be as radical as he wants, as long as he doesn't harm other people. Which means if he's suggesting using the military to produce electric vehicles, ladies and gentlemen, that's not just a bridge too far. That is an intercontinental flight too far. There is no power delegated to the United States in the Constitution to require the production of anything. Anything, not electric vehicles, not anything. And the very idea that this tyrant, this CNN correspondent, literally wants the president to be king. He wants the president to be able to say, if you don't do what I want, we're going to send the military after you. Ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly what led to the Revolutionary War. I'm specifically the king telling us you must do that, whether it's the stamp tax, the deplorable acts. This was the king and parliament, supported by parliament, demanding that the colonists do what was not authorized by the founding documents of England at the time, in violation of their rights. But Paul, if this idea is so radical, if it's so dangerous, why should it let it happen? Because I want everybody to see just how tyrannical these people are. See, we should note that name, Bill Weir. We should recognize that everything he corresponds on is probably tainted by a tyrannical dictatorial bent that wants the federal government to rule over you, that wants the president to rule over you. If I don't get my way, we're going to get the president to use the military to get my way. That's why we let these people speak. because we want to learn just how bad, not their ideas are, but just how bad their view of the world is, just what evil they wish to bring on us. Well, how about this one? The House Oversight and Reform Committee is apparently, I don't know if they've approved it yet, but they're set to approve a bill that would seek to require the federal government to use its authority to help citizens prove who they are online through the provision of optional ID validation services, which augment private sector digital identity and authentication solutions. Again, this is not a power delegated to the United States. It is actually prohibited from the United States. The 10th Amendment says a power not delegated to the United States either resides with the states or with the people. That's why I say a convention of states is not going to fix this problem. They're ignoring the Constitution. The government doesn't have any authority to prove who, to help citizens prove who they are. They don't have any authority to create an ID verification system. They do not have it. It's up to we the people and the people we hire in our states to stand up to Congress, dope slap them metaphorically, and say, no, you're not authorized to do this. This is illegal. This is a violation of the Constitution. It's a violation of your oath of office. We need to learn what's in the Constitution before we start changing the Constitution. I would seriously recommend it. How about looking at this one? According to a CNN report, Google says that they will, if you've got one of those Nest cameras, you know, that they use a doorbell camera, that according to their terms of service, Google will hand that information over to the police if they think it's warranted. Right? They said, if we reasonably believe that we can prevent someone from dying or from suffering serious physical harm, we may provide information to a government agency. Now, people are up in arms. I saw one report going, no privacy. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You forget, Google's a private organization. If you give them your data, they can do whatever they want with it. So you keep thinking of it as your data. It's not your data. It's Google's data. It's data about you, but it's not your data. You didn't create the data. You didn't generate the data. It's not, you know, Google did through their Nest service. And you agreed to this when you agreed to put that cloud-based camera in your system. By the way, you have the same thing when you use Google Home and Amazon Alexa, Siri, HomePods, any of these assistants. You are sending tremendous amounts of data to these companies that they use to analyze and to, A, better the systems, but also to do things like market to you. Now, the problem here we have is, from a constitutional standpoint, the government isn't searching this data. It's being given to them. Think of it this way. If you have a neighbor and you tell your neighbor everything, you're sharing information with them, and they hear something that they feel a little odd, you know, like you've talked about, oh, I don't know, doing something, you know, shooting something up or threatening people, and they go to the police and report it, that's perfectly legitimate. Now, the police should then investigate. But to me, it's just one more reason why I refuse to use these cloud-based services for anything confidential, because it is their data. It is a misunderstanding. It's this idea that the Fourth Amendment protects your privacy. It does not. It protects you from an unreasonable search. It protects you from an unreasonable seizure. It doesn't protect you from taking data, giving it to somebody else, and then having them give it to a third party. Now, this is no way of endorsing the Supreme Court's third party doctrine. If the government is searching for data without a warrant, I don't care where it comes from. I don't care how they require it. It is an unreasonable search. But we're not talking about government searches. We're talking about a company you contract with handing over data you give to them. And all right, we got time for one more. How about this? Do you remember the guy that attacked Congressman Zeldin? He was in New York. He was at a campaign rally. Guy came up and assaulted him. He was then, by the way, released without bail because of New York's bail reform laws and stuff like that. Well, he's been rearrested. Oh, not by the state of New York. No, by the feds. See, he's accused of using a dangerous weapon to assault a member of Congress. Now, a lot of people are going, yeah, he's not going to get away. The feds are going to get him. No. This is one more example of Congress and now the executive branch, and I'm assuming the judicial branch, violating the Constitution of the United States. You see, in order for this case to be heard in federal court, it must pass Article 3, Section 2, which says, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. Well, problem number one, Congress made it a crime to, attack a member of Congress, to assault a member of Congress. There's just one problem. Assaulting a member of Congress on state land or outside of federal land is not a federal purview. It doesn't come up under the Constitution of the United States, and while it may come up under a law of the United States, that law is invalid because, again, regulating assault on property not owned by the United States is not a federal issue. If this had happened in Washington, D.C., absolutely, federal crime, no question. This didn't happen in Washington, D.C. It happened in Perrington, New York, meaning this is a state issue, which means the state of New York needs to deal with it. And the fact that the state of New York seems to be falling down on the job is a problem for the people of the state of New York to deal with. But the idea of just because you work in Congress means you get special protection, that is a violation of equal protection. Now, there is not an equal protection clause that is attached to the federal government, but the idea is there. You are not a special person simply because you win an election. Now, I hope you found this episode interesting, engaging. I hope you learned something today. I hope you learned several somethings today. Again, if you have questions, go to constitutionstudy.com/questions, ask them. I'll be more than happy to answer them. And do me a favor, share this with friends and family. Let other people know they can listen. Weekdays, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on America Out Loud Talk Radio, heard on the iHeartRadio Network. Let them know they can hear these words. They can hear on their apps for Apple, Android, or Alexa. They can listen on the website through the media player. They can listen on podcasts from whatever their favorite podcast is. Whatever they do, take these links, which you can find on the homepage of America Out Loud, share it with others. Help them learn what their rights are. Help them learn how to defend and assert them and how to share the blessings of liberty until they are everywhere from sea to shining sea.